Good evening. Welcome to the fourth presentation, and this is our ninth series of talks on faraway places with strange-sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Library. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, with assistance from our website and virtual librarian, Haiwan Wan, and with assistance from Brian Carson, our reference coordinator. Our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight received his MA and PhD from the University of Maine's Department of Zoology, and after stints of teaching at Colby College and postdoctoral research at Arizona State University, he came to Western in 1993 and has taught biology, has served as director of the University Honors Program, and coordinated the American Democracy Project. He's currently assistant to the provost for QEP, Quality Enhancement Plan, and if you have any questions about that, direct them to Doug after the talk. His teaching and research interests span several continents, have involved studying the evolution of Lake Malawi cichlids in Africa, which he notes on his website include at least 98% of species in a lake that harbors more species of fish than any other lake in the world, conserving species of the gila, among the most endangered fish species in the world in the upper Colorado Basin, using highly sensitive molecular markers to survey a population of genetic structure, and doing genetic analysis of white-tailed deer in Kentucky. He's received numerous grants related to both his research in higher education and his research in biology. His research has been published in the Journal of Wildlife Management, the Encyclopedia of Genetics, and many, many others. He's been involved in studying East African wildlife game species identification. Most recently, in June of 2007, he led a combined student-alumni study abroad group to the Galapagos Islands in Ecuador for a course entitled Biology in a Social Context, Galapagos and Ecuador. In addition to studying biodiversity hotspots, they discussed ecotourism, bioprospecting, and the property rights of indigenous peoples. It's a very timely presentation since, as you know, this year is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, who became one of the island's most celebrated visitors when he reached there on the HMS Beagle, September 15, 1835. Darwin called the islands a paradise for reptiles, and here to talk about some of these slow-moving giants, Professor Doug McElroy.
Yeah, as Brian said, this is sort of a travelogue of sorts for a trip that we took a couple of years ago. And as an evolutionary biologist, it's kind of a pilgrimage for me. I mean, you know, some people are interested in Mecca, Jerusalem, you know, do a lot for me, the Louvre, the Prado, that doesn't do it either. But the Galapagos is it. I mean, if you're an evolutionary biologist, this is it, because this is the chance to stand where Darwin stood, to walk in his footsteps, to see more or less the same things in the same state as he saw them. It's really a fascinating place because it's largely unchanged from what it was 150 or more years ago. And again, this was part of a study abroad experience that involves students, alumni, faculty, and staff of the university. You may see some people here that look familiar. But let me tell you if you're here to see people and human culture and that sort of thing, you better look fast, because there won't be very many people in any of the slides after this. Because in a lot of respects, the beauty and the interest of Galapagos has to do with the absence of people. It's actually an interesting experience to go on one of these trips and really not see anyone other than your traveling party for upwards of a week or so. No civilization, no towns, no nothing. These are the people, and that's about it. Galapagos is really a study in contrasts, and everything is presented in such sharp relief. It's really, really phenomenal. I mean, as you travel around Galapagos, you see things from very barren volcanic peaks to somewhat more lush vegetation in the highland regions of these more eroded volcanoes and so on. You'll see backwater coves, mangrove swamps, quiet, the kinds of things you'd expect to see in Florida, for example. And yet, around the corner, perhaps, you get to stand on some of the newest land on Earth. That is lava that's literally maybe only a few years old. So it's really an interesting contrast. And the organisms themselves are equally dynamic, equally contrasting. You have things like these Galapagos sea lions, somewhat familiar. I mean, everybody's seen sea lions. You can go to San Francisco and see sea lions and seals out on the pier, to things that are more exotic, to be able to stand in water this deep and have the green sea turtles swimming around your legs. That doesn't really happen in very many places. Species like the species of Darwin's finch, that is a variation on a theme. You'll see multiple species of Darwin's finch, to things like this cormorant, which are absolutely unique. So again, everything is there for you. And the really interesting thing about Galapagos is it's all right in front of you. Galapagos is also unique in that the absence of humans and large predators, especially mammals, has resulted in no selection on the animals, on the inhabitants, to have any fear of humans or large organisms. And so, literally, you can stand right next to the animals. It's not like going on safari where you hope to see the animals and you may see them from some distance. You have to avoid stepping on the animals here. And so it's really a fascinating thing. In some respects, it's like going to Disney. You know, everything is right where it's promised to be, sitting there waiting for you to take pictures of it. So it's an interesting place, and it's a spectacular place. It's absolutely phenomenal. And it's certainly famous. I mean, thanks to Darwin, it's one of the most famous habitats in the world. But it's more than that. And what I want to do is I want to try and give you that side of things. Rather than show you a simple travel log, what I want to do is try and convince you that it's not a coincidence that Galapagos was the trigger for Darwin's thinking. Darwin visited lots of places up and down the coast of South America. And he saw lots of things that contributed to the development of his ideas. But it was really Galapagos, and thinking about Galapagos after he returned, that was the real linchpin to his ideas. And what I'm going to try and convince you of is that's not accidental. It's not coincidental. That Galapagos had to be that place because of its characteristics, because of the way things are presented to you for observation. It had to be the place where that intellectual connection would be made. And it's a spectacular place. And so what I'm going to try and do is try and give you a window into the world of Galapagos to try and help you see it better. So when you see slides of the animals and the volcanoes, it'll put it in some context for you. You'll be able to appreciate what went into Darwin's thinking and how the characteristics of the islands themselves were really critical to that realization that he made. So, what makes Galapagos unique? If you're a real estate agent, one thing you know is that it's about location, location, location. And the same thing is true here. To give you a little bit of orientation, Galapagos, the archipelago, consists of 13 major islands and six or so smaller islands, and then a whole bunch of rocks and little protrusions out of the ocean. It's equatorial, sits just below the equator off the coast of Ecuador. And there are three aspects to this location thing that are going to be critical: isolation, geology, and climate. What I'm going to do is go through each of these and tell you some stories about that and about the animals and how those two things are interrelated. We're going to travel all around here, spend a lot of time actually in these western islands, Isabela, Fernandina, and so on, because they're some of the most spectacular of all of them. So, first thing. Galapagos is a long way from anywhere. It lies 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. So this is from Google Earth, which I had a great deal of fun playing with. The equator is right here. That's on the equator. This is the equatorial line right here. And it's 600 miles from here to there. Okay? It's out in the middle of nowhere. And if you back this out a little bit, you wouldn't see anything for a long way. The next closest bit of land is a small island, Cocos Islands, which are off in this direction, about 750 miles. The nearest landmass beyond that is Easter Island and some South Pacific islands that are about 2,300 miles away. So it's out in the middle of nowhere, okay, which is really critical to understanding what Galapagos is all about. So imagine the scenario. You're talking about relatively small islands, 600 miles offshore out in the middle of the Pacific. Okay. Imagine yourself to be a seed or an insect or even a bird drifting in the wind, flying through the air out over the ocean. What are your chances of hitting that speck or one of those 13 specks 600 miles offshore. Okay, so the prospects for colonizing the Galapagos Islands are pretty random, pretty low. And so colonization is limited. You know, imagine seeds floating out. What are really the chances that they're going to colonize this island versus this island? And if they do, what are the chances that they're going to stick? That organism is going to become established and become resident on the island. And if you're talking about something which is a sexually reproducing organism, the prospect is doubly daunting because it takes two. Unless you happen to be a pregnant female, you better hope somebody else was lucky enough to land in basically the same spot as you. So colonization is very, very difficult and very random. And so as a consequence, when you travel around Galapagos, you see very, very simple ecosystems, relatively few numbers of species, and often quite barren landscapes. Lots of Galapagos look like you're walking on the moon because there's literally nothing there. This is the slopes of Bartolomé, which is one of the places that Darwin visited. And if you saw Master and Commander, the part where he's running around on the island, that was reported to be Bartolomé. But it's a relatively simple ecosystem. You don't see many species of plants in this. You certainly don't see any animals at all. If you looked really closely, you'd see some small lizards and so on, but not a whole lot else going on. Even in the more mature ecosystems, up in the highlands regions, where species diversity is highest, it's still a very, very simple ecosystem. On the entire Galapagos Island chain, there are only about 109 species of vertebrates, and only about 180 species of plants on the entire island, and many of those evolved on the islands. Again, the colonization is low, the species diversity is low. As a result, the interactions among species are simple. Okay, so Galapagos is in many ways a model system. It's a simplified version of a lot of what we would observe in other places. And you can contrast that with some of the things that we saw. This is, along with a shot of the people, this is the only slide that doesn't come from Galapagos. One of the other places we visited were the cloud forests on the western slopes of the Andes at about 9,000 feet. Contrast what we just saw in Galapagos with something like this, where the number of species is effectively incalculable. In the 100-acre preserve that we visited, there were 400 to 500 species of birds and who knows how many species of plants. And every conceivable niche was filled, from things like this orchid, which are parasitic on other plants, to this tiny little species of frog, which is almost undetectable. I mean, it just happens to be chance that it landed on my wife's hand. You know, otherwise, what is the prospect that you could observe, much less understand what's going on with that species in here? It's a very daunting problem. And so the simplicity of Galapagos makes understanding biological relationships that much clearer. I would argue that it would be almost impossible for Darwin to have figured out what was going on here. You need something simple. When you understand the simple things, then you can understand the more complex things. So the simplicity is important. And it's not only a problem of colonization of the islands from the mainland. We're dealing with a whole series of islands which are separated by fairly deep ocean. They may not be very far away, but they're separated by deep ocean. This is how we traveled among the islands, but we're the only species that has that luxury. Again, the birds, the tortoises, the iguanas, the insects, the plants have to make their own way without three meals a day and chefs and the whole thing. Okay, so colonization of one island to the next is also kind of episodic, sporadic, random. And we see all kinds of interesting consequences as a result of that. We see things like Galapagos tortoises. People serving as a reference point, serving as a sort of a contrast to give you a sense of scale and so on. Okay, these are some of the Galapagos tortoises. And Galapagos tortoises are a great example of one of the fundamental characteristics of Galapagos wildlife, and that's adaptive radiation. Darwin's finches are the other famous example. In the case of the tortoises, we have a situation where originally were 12 distinct subspecies of tortoise distributed around the islands, all descended from a common ancestor. In the case of Darwin's finches, same sort of thing. That's a classic example of adaptive radiation, where a single ancestral species colonizes different areas and evolves independently, diverges, and generates genetically distinct descendants. In this case, subspecies, in the case of Darwin's finches, good biological species. And it's a result of this inter-island colonization, or the characteristics. These are big animals, by the way. They're very, very big animals. Again, the Western Galapagos as an example. This is the island of Isabella. This is the island of Fernandina. Again, the equator runs right through here. Isabella consists of five volcanic peaks. There's actually an eroded sixth peak here, which is partially submerged. But the main island consists of five distinct volcanoes. Each one of these volcanic peaks has a population of tortoise. And the tortoises inhabit the highland regions, the higher elevations, the grasslands, which are up somewhat higher. These are the bison of the Galapagos. These are the grassland herbivores that roam around and forage on cactus. They forage on vegetation on the ground and so on. Each one of these volcanoes houses a distinct subspecies of tortoise. Morphologically distinct. Some of them look like this. This is the one major form of Galapagos tortoises. This is the saddle-backed form, where the front of the shell has this very high crest. These subspecies, some of which occur on some of these peaks, inhabit drier areas, and they feed on cactus off the ground. So they need to be able to raise their head up to forage on the cactus. They also use it in defense displays. They're more aggressive than the other forms because resources are more limiting, water is limiting, and so on. And they use it as a display to be able to stand up and raise up as high as they can and try and dominate one another. But saddle-backed tortoises are one of the two main types. The other main type are these dome-shaped tortoises, the more common and larger species. Some of the subspecies on Isabella are dome-shaped tortoises. And so as you go from place to place, within literally a half a mile of walk, what we have really are five sky islands, five regions of habitat for tortoises surrounded by inhospitable lowland. And so as they randomly colonize these peaks, they're isolated from one another, and they evolve in different directions depending on the local conditions. It's really a colonization effect, and the colonization is, and the divergence that goes with it, is acting like a multiplier. It's turning the crank, if you will, of speciation. And again, Darwin's finches are a classic example of this. This is a montage of several different forms. There are 14 species of Darwin's finch distributed in and around the Galapagos. And if you go to your field guide on page 74, if I were to pass this out, you could try really fast to figure out which species these are. I'm not sure I could tell you. I think there are probably three, maybe four different species on here, but it's somewhat difficult to really tell them apart. But again, morphologically distinct. Darwin's finches differ primarily in the shape of their bills. These are seed-eating birds for the most part, and they use their bills like pliers. And just like the pliers in your toolkit, the big heavy pliers are used for crushing big things, but they're lousy at picking up little things. Needle-nose pliers, on the other hand, more like what this species has for a bill, are really good at manipulating small objects, but they don't generate a lot of crushing force. So the diet of these species, large seeds taken by these large-billed birds and small seeds taken by these smaller-billed birds, contributing to the evolution of different forms in different places, depending on the particular environment. So again, the colonization and the local adaptation is turning the crank, generating species as these move from place to place in a repeating manner. So that's a really critical thing that Darwin was able to observe. As he went from place to place, he saw very, very similar things that were distinct for no apparent reason at the time. And that's sort of what got him thinking. Turns out he missed the entire tortoise thing. You know, the governor of the Galapagos told him that you could tell where a tortoise came from by the shape of its shell, and that just went right over his head. He never did get that. But he got it right later on. The second aspect of the uniqueness of Galapagos is its geology. Now, I'm sure most of you know, if not all of you know, that the Earth's crust consists of a series of movable plates that slide over one another and under one another and bump up against one another. Galapagos lies on the northern edge of the Nazca Plate, and this plate is sliding in a southeasterly direction and subducting, going under the South American Plate at the Andes, which is why the Andes are so volcanically active, because you have these two plates running into one another and one going under the other. Okay? As this plate goes under, the rock melts and forms a magma layer. Okay, that flows back over. So what you need to know is Galapagos is sitting right here, drifting this way, drifting in a southeasterly direction. Okay, and as it does that, the plate is riding over a volcanic hotspot, a place in the crust where magma is close to the surface and periodically bubbles through the plate and blurks up an island. Okay, and so over time, what's happening is islands are, as the plate slides over the hotspot, islands or volcanoes are bubbling out from the Earth's crust and forming islands or portions of islands. Okay, so if we look at this portion of the plate, what we see are islands. The southeasterly islands are lower and less distinct than these northwest islands and the volcanoes. These are older because the plate is moving this way, and these were over the hot spot millions of years ago. The hot spot right now is right underneath of Fernandina Island. So this is a very active region because this is where the hot spot is. These islands were over the hot spot maybe 4 to 5 million years ago. These islands are about that age. Fernandina is the newest, the youngest island, less than 700,000 years old. So as we move from southeast to northwest, the islands get younger, they get more geologically active, they get higher because they haven't eroded away as much. So when you look at the topography, again from Google Earth, you see this kind of thing. You see these very pronounced volcanic peaks, okay, sticking out of the ocean. This is a place you'll see some pictures of in a minute. This is called Darwin Lake. Darwin is thought to have visited this site as well. A lot of people visited the site looking for fresh water. It turns out that's not fresh water. But it is a really interesting example of just seeing these peaks sticking out of the, basically out of the open ocean. If you, in real life, this is the kind of topography that you see. When you stand here and you can see these volcanic peaks very distinctly, and you can see these ejecta cones, these are basically splatter from when the volcanoes shoot lava out. This is a big drop of lava. Geology becomes a lot more obvious in this kind of a situation than it is when you're going around Mammoth Cave Ridge or the Appalachians or even the Himalayas or the Rockies. This is pretty obvious. The geology is so evident that, and it had to have influenced Darwin's thinking. And these volcanoes are active. So again, going back to the colonization thing, these volcanoes are active. This is from 2008, recording eruptions on Isabella at Cerro Azul, which is the southernmost volcano on Isabella. It was erupting last year. Fernandina erupted in 1997 or so. These volcanoes are very, very active, and they imperil the wildlife. If you read down here, although it didn't happen, there was a possibility that there was a concern that the lava flows were going to threaten the subspecies of tortoise which inhabited those islands. And as they had done in previous eruptions on other craters, they were preparing to airlift tortoises off of the islands with helicopters. Basically come down and pick them up with the helicopters and you know, carry them to safety. Okay, so these organisms are inhabiting this volcanically active area, which erupts fairly often. And so, as a consequence, this is what you get to do. Okay, this is the island of Fernandina. This is looking back towards the volcano. This is new land, fresh rock, barren, large areas of completely barren habitat. New habitat, and you get to see life just finding a way, just starting to get a foothold and establish new ecosystems, new habitats, new communities, and so on. So it's a very dynamic system. And now we've got two pieces of the puzzle. We've got the colonization, and we've got this regeneration of new habitat, and this dynamic geology fitting together. The organisms, in many respects, regardless of what kind of organism they are and where they exist on the habitat, are effectively trapped between volcano and sea. There's the volcano, and there's the ocean, and there's the space in between, and that's where the organisms are trying to get established and survive. And so there have to be some unique adaptations that the organisms have to deal with these challenges, to deal with this fairly rough habitat, and also to deal with the possibility that you're going to get lava dumped on your head on a fairly regular basis. Now, the third piece of the importance of Galapagos is its climate. And it's really kind of paradoxical. Galapagos doesn't have the type of climate that you would expect. It doesn't look like Hawaii by any stretch of the imagination. And it's because, largely because of the ocean circulation patterns. Again, being in the southern hemisphere, the major circulation patterns in the southern hemisphere are counterclockwise. Whereas in the northern hemisphere, they're clockwise, right? You flush your toilet, it spins a certain direction, you know. But the flow is counterclockwise. The winds and feeding Galapagos are basically coming in this direction, from southeast to northwest. That, coupled with the flow of this Humboldt current, which comes up the coast of South America, and when it gets near the equator, bends westward. Okay, this is an Antarctic current. This is cold water. And as it bends westward, you get delivery of this cold water along the equator, and along with it, a lot of nutrients. Okay, so you have very cold, nutrient-rich currents flowing past Galapagos. Okay, because of the rotation of the Earth, because of the wind and the Ekman spirals that are created, and all those physical oceanography things that I used to know from when I took the class, you've got cold water moving from east to west over the Galapagos. Okay? As a consequence of that cold, nutrient-rich water, you have very, very high primary productivity, very, very high algal growth. Okay, the colors here, these are satellite shots, obviously. The colors here represent the amount of chlorophyll, the amount of plankton, phytoplankton, in the water. Red is a lot. It'd be nice if they kind of made it really green or something. But red is high. And so here again, Isabella, Fernandina, you can see very, very high marine productivity around Galapagos. Okay, because of the cold water and the high nutrient water that's flowing past it most of the time. We'll talk later about the effects of El Nino, which is another one of those periodic events in Galapagos. Here's a shot of primary productivity from an El Nino year. Much, much lower levels of chlorophyll, much, much lower levels of nutrient resources in the water. Because during El Nino, the current patterns reverse, and what you get is pushing of warm Pacific water from west to east. So the flow reverses. The Humboldt current breaks down, and you get warm water moving this way. The warm water doesn't have nearly the amount of nutrients in it. It's not nearly as suitable for algal growth. So you see things changing very dramatically in El Nino years. We'll see what that does to the organisms. So you get a very odd sort of climate on Galapagos, and a very distinct difference between land and sea. On land, it's a very dry, it's a desert, but it's a cool desert. Okay, high temperatures are maybe 85 degrees during the day, something like that, dropping down into the 60s at night. But it's very, very arid. I mean, it's kind of striking to see these big Opuntia cactus growing right on the edge of the water. You know, it's not what you would typically see. Very, very arid habitats on land. Very low levels of nutrients, productivity, food resources. This doesn't look like the cloud forest. Okay, it's very barren on land. But by contrast, the water is just very productive, loaded with algae, loaded with food, and exploited by lots of organisms living at the interface, like these blue-footed boobies, which are nesting on land but feeding in the water, right offshore. So you also see some interesting kinds of effects in terms of the organisms that live there. Because it's cool, and productive, you see odd, what you would consider to be odd creatures like penguins at the equator. Okay? And in fact, the Galapagos penguins are the only species of penguin which inhabit land north of the equator that exist in the northern hemisphere. The very northern tips of Isabella Island are in the northern hemisphere. And these penguins are making their home at the equator, which is a little bit odd. It's also interesting that when you're snorkeling, they're swimming around you as well. You also see green sea turtles resident among the coves, literally in water this deep. What we don't have pictures of, other kinds of organisms that you see in water this deep, like Galapagos white-tipped sharks and things like that, that come literally right up to the beach, eagle rays that will come right up to the beach. You know, you don't see that in very many other places. And again, you see species like these blue-footed boobies that are plunge diving for fish literally 50 feet offshore. Again, you're talking about specks in the open ocean, but this ocean is highly productive, which makes for an interesting set of contrasts. Now, what I want to do is kind of put it all together and talk about it in the context of two case studies, two of the more archetypical species of Galapagos, the marine iguanas and the flightless cormorants. You can't talk about Galapagos without talking about these. These are what people think of when they think of Galapagos. And again, the stories are very, very similar. These are technically terrestrial animals, but ecologically, they're much more marine animals than they are terrestrial. And when we'll see similar kinds of... We'll sort of go back and forth a little bit, but these are one of a kind. These only occur on Galapagos. There's nothing else like them anywhere else in the world. Again, another Google Earth shot. This is Fernandina, the island of Fernandina, the westernmost island. This is the middle and northern part of Isabella, the seahorse-shaped island. Darwin Lake is right here. That's the shot you saw before. The marine iguanas live all over the Galapagos. They inhabit every island all over the place. The flightless cormorants, however, have a very, very restricted distribution. Flightless cormorants exist in about three places. They exist here, they exist over here, and they exist maybe a little bit here, maybe a little bit over there. But Fernandina is a great place to see both of these species and to really get a sense of what they're all about. So if we fly over the crest of this volcano, the height of this volcano, this caldera, is about 4,900 feet. So we're talking about going from 4,900 feet to sea level in a pretty short amount of space. So as we fly over and head northeast, we come to this place. This is Punta Espinosa. And this is the place where all these next few pictures you'll see come from. It's a little spit of lava sticking out into the ocean. Think back to the primary productivity, where all the red was. That's right here. This is where all the action is. So if you walk around, when you tour Fernandina, you basically come ashore right here and you get to walk all around in here. And what you see are iguanas by the hundreds, thousands, if you will. And Darwin was fascinated by the iguanas. The story goes that he was a little confused by them initially. The legend says that he wanted to catch these things, and being experienced with lots of terrestrial organisms, he figured, well, okay, what I'll do is I'll chase them towards the water, and I'll use the water as sort of a barrier, like trapping a point guard against the baseline, right? I'm going to run towards the water, and then I've got them, and I can catch them. Well, that didn't work, because as he chased them towards the water, they just ran into the water and disappeared. And it took him a few tries, again, the legend has it, it took him a few tries to realize that the way to catch the iguanas was to turn around and chase them towards land, because that's where they didn't want to be. These are effectively marine species. They feed on algae underwater, offshore. Algae growing on the rocks underwater. But it's an interesting survival problem, because the reptiles, they don't have the ability to regulate their body temperature. They rely on external heat sources, sun, to warm them. So one adaptation that you see, which is common of many species in Galapagos, is that they're black, largely black. It makes it tough to take pictures of animals, because all the animals are black and the lava is black. This is both an anti-predation adaptation, makes them a little bit hard to find, easy to step on, but it also absorbs heat. In the case of the reptiles, it helps them warm up during the day. So these organisms, before they can go out and forage, they have to warm up. Remember, it's dropping down pretty cold at night, into the 50s or 60s. And so it takes them about 3 hours of basking in the sun, like this, all piled up on one another, to warm their bodies up, to raise their metabolism enough to allow them to go out into the ocean and forage. So they'll sit here for 3 hours or so, warm themselves up, and then they'll head out into the water, and they're able to dive and spend about 30 minutes submerged, swimming around the rocks, foraging on algae. But again, the downside of being a reptile kicks in, because the water's cold. So every minute that they're in the ocean, their body temperature is going down, they're getting less and less able to move, and it's a difficult problem that they have to deal with. They have to stay in the water long enough to get enough food, but not so long that their bodies cool so much that they can't get back out of the water. Okay, so they can stay in the water for maybe a half an hour or so, feeding like crazy on the algae, and then they have to make their way back out and warm back up again. They may get 2 dives a day. Okay, so 3 hours of warming for 30 minutes of feeding. Now that's the upside of being a reptile. You don't have to eat much. But it's an interesting problem. These are effectively marine organisms. And you can see some of their adaptations. They have these really powerful front legs and these big claws for grabbing a hold of the rocks, because remember, this is a tidal area, and so there's a lot of dynamic flow going on. So they have to be able to establish and hold their position while they forage on the algae. They also have to have a way to get the salt water out of their bodies. And so what you'll see them doing, sitting there like this basking, is periodically they'll spit salt water out of their nostrils to try and purge that. But they're fascinating animals. Think about El Nino in a minute with these, though. Because remember what happens in El Nino is the productivity in the marine environment goes way down. Food becomes shortened, limited in the water during El Nino years. But conversely, what happens in El Nino is that the land becomes much more productive. The effect of El Nino on Galapagos is to warm the air, which causes more rain. Okay, so the islands are receiving much more rain, but the water around the islands is warmer, less algae in the water. So the whole dynamic of the climate and the environment switches from low productivity on land, high productivity on the ocean, to the exact opposite. During El Nino, terrestrial organisms do great. Marine organisms have a really hard time. Under normal conditions, it's exactly the opposite. My favorite is the flightless cormorant. There's nothing like this in the world. There are lots of species of cormorants all around the world, and if you see them on riverbanks and so on, they're always like this. They're drying their wings. Right? These are birds around the world that forage on fish, so they're diving birds. In order to dive, they have very little oil on their feathers, because the oil would create buoyancy. And so they have very little oil on their feathers, which means they have to dry their wings before they can fly. So wherever you go, you see cormorants out there drying their wings. Well, these flightless cormorants spend all day long drying their wings, even though there's not going to be any flight, because those wings are completely useless. Nevertheless, they're still cormorants. These live, again, this is Punta Espinosa. These live on the lava rocks, right on the edge of the water, and probably never move more than 200 yards in their entire life. Okay, just basically out into the water and back. They're kind of ungainly. The females will sit on the nests, and the males bring them presents of seaweed to build the nest. But they're living their entire life sort of clambering around on these rocks, doing what cormorants do. But they'll spend their entire life within a couple of hundred yards of this particular space. Again, colonization is not big for cormorants. And they forage on fish in the water. They don't fly. There's no need to fly. Their food supply is in the water. But again, if we think about El Nino now, when El Nino kicks in, the productivity in the water goes down. So now the food supply for iguanas and for cormorants goes way down. You see very, very dramatic effects. In the 1987 El Nino year, some of the populations of iguanas decreased by 90%, okay, because the food became so limiting. In terms of the cormorant, there are probably only about 1,500 members of that species that exist in those three or four locations. So all of the individuals in the entire species in the entire world account for about 1,500 individuals. But during El Nino years, that may drop down to as low as 400 individuals. So because El Nino is a cyclical event, these populations are going through these very, very dramatic fluctuations. They're used to that. I mean, they've evolved to deal with those sorts of things. They have the ability to rebound very, very quickly. But El Nino is also a good model, or bad model, depending on how you look at it, for the effects of global warming. What's predicted to happen, the same as with hurricanes here, is with global warming, the intensity of El Nino events is predicted to become greater, more significant. So now, instead of knocking out 90% of the iguanas, how many are you going to knock out? Instead of dropping this population of cormorants down to 400, how many are you going to drop out? These are very, very sensitive species. Okay? They've evolved to deal with the dynamic nature of volcanic eruptions and El Nino events. dealing with global warming consequences is a very, very different story. These organisms are living on the edge, both literally and ecologically. And it's not just these unique species. In an El Nino event in the late 80s, three breeding seasons of sea lions were lost as a result of El Nino. So all of these organisms are very, very closely tied to the marine environment. These climatic changes, both regular and human amplified, are presenting perennial problems to their survival. Now, the interesting thing, too, about Galapagos is that the government of Ecuador is amazingly committed to preserving the Galapagos. Almost the entire island chain is a national park, and the regulations are very, very extreme because it's recognized as such a sensitive habitat. When you go from island to island, before you get back on the boat, you have to rinse off your entire body to make sure you don't transport any sand or any small organisms, seeds or anything from one island to the next. It's very, very highly regulated. Last year, the government of Ecuador passed a new constitution which became the first in the world to guarantee civil rights in the constitution to organisms, to natural organisms and ecosystems. So they have the same rights, the inalienable rights that humans have, also are extended to organisms and the habitats in the constitution. So Ecuador is very, very proactive in protecting them. But it's not just Ecuador that controls the fate of Galapagos and a lot of these other places. It's really a global problem. So hopefully, this has given you a sort of a window, a little bit of a connection, maybe that you don't get from some other shows about the connection between you and what's happening, in Galapagos that you may or hopefully will, but may not ever see. Again, it's a fascinating place, and that's all I have for you. I'm glad to try and answer any questions you might have.
Are there cities there that people live there all along?
There are about, population of Ecuador, or Galapagos, is about 25,000. And there are three, I wouldn't call them cities, there are three population centers. There's one on the island of Santa Cruz, which is really the tourist launching point. That's where all the supply ships come in for the cruise ships and so on. And then there's a small village on island of Isabela, and there's one on San Cristobal, which is in the southeastern side. But other than those three areas, some houses sort of up in the highlands of Santa Cruz, 97% of the islands is national park, so completely uninhabited. And actually, you're only allowed to visit very, very limited amounts of space and locations on the island. Most of the really critical areas are off limits to anyone but the scientists. So yeah, there are people, but they're trying to regulate that. They're trying to keep that down. Yes.
Are people's lives kind of slowed down by drug usage down there?
The residents of Galapagos, I think, would argue that their lives are slowed down by regulations on fishing, which is their historic economic base. There have been regulations put on because, in addition to Galapagos being a national park, there's a large marine reserve which was established offshore to protect the marine environment, which is also very unique. I really don't know. It's pretty isolated. My guess is it's not a particular problem. The inhabitants of Galapagos, it's primarily a fishing-based economy, switching a little bit more to tourism now in at least a couple of the islands. But historically, it was a small fishing.
Off the big island of Hawaii, there's a new island forming up on the southeastern, out in the ocean, off the big island. But in this case, the island off the southeast is the old
island.
Why is it that in Hawaii that's a new island forming?
The plates are moving in different directions, presumably. Uh-huh. I don't know the plate structure in Hawaii, but it just depends on, you imagine you've got this big plate and it's sliding in a particular direction over the hot spot, and it just depends on which direction it's sliding. And then actually in Galapagos it's a little bit more complex. There's a little bit of circular rotation going on because there are actually three plates that come together, and it's a little bit more, that's why the islands are not in a nice line like they are in Hawaii, because the things have kind of moved in several different directions. Mike?
How often do the volcanoes erupt? Is there any regularity to it? And when they do, any idea how dangerous it is?
It depends. The one last year didn't turn out to be very much. There was some gassing, but there wasn't any real significant lava flow. Back in 97, there was not a Mount St. Helens type eruption, but there was a significant lava flow in one of the other volcanoes in Isabela. And Fernandina, I think, last erupted in the late 80s. So, I mean, they're erupting pretty often, in a geologic sense, all the time, right? But it's different, different volcanoes each time. Basically, the whole western end is volcanically active, and any one of those volcanoes could start erupting at more or less any time.
Your trip, how did you get there? Did you go over by boat? Did you fly in, Doug?
The way that it works is you fly to mainland Ecuador, you fly to Quito or Guayaquil, and then you fly out to Galapagos. On one of the islands, one of the small islands, there used to be a military base, so there's an airport, an airstrip there. And they fly 727s out there every day to shuttle the tourists out. The boats are stationed out in Galapagos. And then from there, most of the time, you would get on one of those cruise boats and go around. There are a few land-based tours, but by and large, you fly out to Galapagos, get on your boat, and then visit various sites around. It's a great way to travel. And most of the cruise ships hold 12 passengers. We had 20, so we chartered the whole vessel. The largest one holds about 100. 150, something like that. But most of them are 12, 16, something like that.
You said there was an absence of predatory mammals and other vertebrates. What about like rodents? Are there mice and rats?
There are.
That's kind of something you expect to see everywhere.
Yeah, there are two species of rats that are native to Galapagos, and they occur on a couple of the islands. Actually, Fernandina has a species of rat. And there have been some introductions, accidental, maybe not so accidental introductions. Some of the islands have feral goats, some burrows, and there have been some rats, Norway rats, that have been introduced, but nothing bigger than that. And only the rats, the two rat species, are native. All the rest are introduced.
Are they trying to remove the feral?
Mm-hmm. They have some programs in place to eradicate them. And that is in part why some of the areas are blocked off to tourists, because they're going in there and trying to eradicate the goats and things like that. Yeah, so they're trying to do that. It's not easy though. It's pretty tough habitat sometimes.
How old is the new island?
About 500,000 years old, something like that.
Has El Nino always? But we've just begun, seem to me, hearing about it in the last 20, 30 years, but has it always
No, it's,
been?
It's always been there.
Always been there. Mm-hmm.
But the reasons are still sort of unclear. I mean, it's still a somewhat poorly understood phenomenon. But yeah, it's a regular occurrence, and the cycle is between 7 and 15 years, somewhere in there, tends to occur. The reason you heard about it in the 80s and 90s is where there were some very severe El Niños, and actually kind of a lot of them. Late 80s, early 90s. There was only about 5 years between them in there, and those were two of the worst. So that's why you've heard more about them, because you had a couple really severe ones in a row.
When you make an expedition to the island, about how long do you stay for, I guess, research time? Is it a long period of time? You're taking students down for a few weeks, or how does all that work?
It would depend. I mean, the research scientists that go down there will often spend several months down there. But there's quite a lot of permitting process required in getting access to the islands and so on. The tourist trips are typically between 4 days and a week. And the way that it works is you typically travel from island to island at night. And so in the morning, you have an excursion which lasts about 2.5 hours. And then you come back and have lunch while the boat is traveling to a new site. And then there's an afternoon excursion. So it's a very civilized expedition. It's almost frightening to call it an expedition, because it's sort of a British Empire type of expedition,
No tea on the board.
Yeah, it's not roughing it by any stretch.
We got a question back here.
No, just John. Well, it's now time. Who's got the box? Now time for our door prize, and we have a travel guide on the Galapagos giveaway.
Do we have everybody?
No.
And again, this is a compliment of WKU Libraries.
Eric, do you have a question?
Yeah. How much damage did the volcanoes make?
Well, it can wipe out a lot of stuff, but it also gives a chance for new things to live, too. It makes new habitat for them. So it's good and it's also bad, but...
Do the animals not sense when their eruptions are going to occur?
You know, I don't know.
I didn't think there would be some sort of natural instinct.
I'm not sure what you would be able to do about it. I mean, you can't. They really don't have very many options. As I said, they're sort of trapped in there. There's not a lot of options.
Well, let me shake it up and. All right, we'll hold that up. Let Doug pick one.
Such pressure.
And the lucky person is
Hank Hansen.
Excellent.
Thank you for writing legibly. That would have been embarrassing otherwise.
We have a little Megan.
Because we both work at the university, we know we don't have a lot of money, but we certainly have a little gift to remind you that we have spent some time together.
Thank you.
I know.
Heavy.
Well, on behalf of WK Libraries, I want to thank you for making a fascinating presentation, one of the most interesting ones we've had in 8 or 9 years, so thank you.
And you say that to everyone.
We want to thank all of you for joining us, and hope you'll be our guest next month, when on March the 5th, one of the world's most famous forensic anthropologists, in his guise as mystery writer, Dr. Bill Bass, and his partner John Jefferson will be here to talk about the Body Farm novels. Mm-hmm. And then we hope you'll join us later in March when I think our guest will be Joe Trafton to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls and his research in Israel. And thanks again for joining us, and have a wonderful evening.
How are we doing on time? Did we get it in on time?
Perfect. Right on time.